Welcome to the Dastan Goy podcast, a collective exploration of Pakistani history and culture.
In this episode of Dastan Goy podcast, we get to sit down with Natasha Nurani, an artist, curator, musical performer, and researcher. Natasha talks to us about the founding of Lahore Music Meets and her personal journey in the Pakistani music industry. She also gives us insight into the overall music scene in Pakistan and the sense of community within it. So let's get straight to Natasha.
Musician and an ethnomusicologist, which means that I research the relationship between music and culture, specifically with a focus on Pakistan and Pakistani pop music. And I also curate events. So I curate music, not just events. I'm one of the co-founders of the Lahore Music Meet, which we started off in 2015, right out of college. And that's basically been like an annual festival that caters to just recognizing and kind of facilitating new talent that may not kind of make it to corporate shows or anything of that nature, but also to just do a lot of community building and showcase and just like allow engagement through workshops. And just like, it's a nice place to be for a few days. So there's that. And then I just generally help various musicians, artists, agencies kind of curate the kind of sounds they need to have. And but primarily I'm a musician.
Awesome. So, okay. Ab iske saath, let's just break all of that down a little bit, right? So you went to SOAS, you came back. When was this?
So I went to SOAS in 2018, came back a year later in 2019.
Okay, and Lahore Music Meets, kab shuru hua tha?
2015 mein.
Oh, so you went after?
Yeah.
Okay, got it. Okay, so let's go to LMM.
Yes.
Dude, there are so many musicians in Pakistan. There are so many subcultures in Pakistan. And I remember the first call that we had, and you mentioned, hey, Ahmad, if you want to get to know the underground scene, like, I'll help you there. And I was like, I did not know how diverse and how much exists in Pakistan. So what I basically would love to know, because I mean, I've also, without knowing that it was Lahore Music Meets, I have attended one.
Amazing.
Ever so slightly, because mera khayal se Alhambra mein tha ek saal ya hamesha hota hai, I don't know.
Hamesha udhar hi hota hai.
So I was in Alhambra because I was like discovering Lahore at that point, and I was like walking around, and like, you know, there's a couple of galleries that are around there, or mera khayal se shayad Biennale bhi ho raha tha tab. I'm not sure. Like it was something around that time, and there was like rush laga hua tha. There was musicians everywhere. Like the whole crowd was there. It looked amazing. And I like was there for like, I think at least half an hour to an hour because I had to kind of do all of the rounds.
Yeah.
But I did not realize what was happening until I had walked away. And then looking at the historical relevance and importance in the culture scene, Lahore ke andar, like, and then you know what the beauty of Pakistan, at least for the last 6 months, what I've been discovering, because before that I knew nothing, I wasn't looking into this at all. And now because of Dastan Goy, we've started looking into it. There are so many subgenres, whether it be mixing, whether it be like pop, contemporary, khayal ho gaya, classical ho gaya, and each has its own kind of narrative that's going along and its own kind of people that are telling its stories. And then there's like sometimes where you get people that kind of combine all of these things and make something completely new, and mix genres together. Like the most recent example that I can think of off the top of my head was like Mughle Funk and Misha Shafi and Abdullah Siddiqui. And like, I'm just blown away. Like, how was it? Like, I want to know from you the evolution that you found and the reason behind why you wanted to start LMM, and also the evolution that you've seen up until today in musicians, in the culture of music, and the industry of music in Pakistan.
I mean, that is like a massive question. Like, what's happening for like 70 plus years? But like, I will, let me see how I can engage with this. I can speak from firsthand experience from the 90s onwards, and just in terms of what music culture had been back then, which was you had one TV channel, eventually you had SDN, so you had a little bit more happening. The main means of consuming music was the radio, and then obviously cassettes were all the rage because they were affordable, material to be able to, you know, get music recordings of various artists. A lot of underground artists started coming up back then. There's a huge rock movement up until the early 2000s. And then we saw that kind of erupt with like a Pepsi Battle of the Bands. You see that kind of grow into indus music with acts like Moody, EP, Call, and a bunch of others, and then also like the underground of that underground also taking place simultaneously. And then you had like a lull and then a Coke studio boom, and then you just had a corporate boom. But what was happening simultaneously, so if Coke studio started in 2008, around about 2009-10, a lot of various musicians in their early to mid 20s started springing up in Karachi, Lahore, Islamabad, everywhere. You had, you know, kind of, which is now commonly known as the indie scene, as if that word means anything, but sure, for the sake of this, we will call them indie. And so they sprung up. You had acts like Poor Rich Boy, Sikandar Kamandar, you had Orange Noise, a couple of Red Blood Cat, Natasha Humaira Ejaz, so many of these artists who were just kind of like, and these young people who had just started working on their sound in different cities, and that eventually came together through festivals. Like primarily my interaction, like my biggest moment was in 2014 when I attended True Brew Records, Storm in a Teacup, which was a festival with, I think, the best lineup possible. Like it was an all-day festival. It was a place to just where you can't like immediately felt a sense of community, and that kind of, that was great in knowing at like in your early 20s, oh, okay, you can do a festival. This is great. You could just go and hang out and listen to music that you like. Because I mean, that wasn't, it wasn't accessible to be out in spaces listening to music throughout the late 2000s and early 2010s. Like it just wasn't, your venues had shut down because of security. Schools had been shut down because of security issues and things like that. So like you're outing your performance spaces, they shrunk. You know, YouTube had been banned around about the same time. There was just no way to get in touch. So you really had to be looking to listen to these acts. And so they sprung up. And so in 2015, Zara Paracha and I and a few other people, we basically co-founded the Lahore Music Meet, and we were just in our last semester of college. So this was like a side gig that we would do in the evenings after classes, if I went to classes that day, which was unlikely. But still, the festival happened. That's what matters. So basically it was just for I think us, we kind of very much were attuned to the fact that we wanted to be musicians and that we wanted to see some kind of community and have some way in to the music industry, because getting into the music industry is a very hard, you know, you need to, it's not even about nepotism. It's just that there's no ladder. There is no entry point. I wish if I could like just find entry-level jobs in the music industry in Pakistan, that would yield some amount of Google results, but it won't. Yeah. It'll just leave you confused. And then obviously, you know, so that was just definitely something that was putting us off. And I think it was important for us to, and both of us were researching music as well for our undergrad. So we just kind of did our dissertation through the festival. And that also worked out well. And so the idea was to just provide free, easy, accessible music to people, because the constant thing was Pakistan mein to music hi nahi ban raha, Pakistan mein to ye nahi ho raha. Like people coming back like from like visiting just like Pakistan, just being like, I haven't heard anything but Coke Studio, and it's like, but there's so much more. Please just try harder. Which eventually I realized is just a matter of just like getting these people to an audience. And that in itself is a task and a half, but it seems to have worked out. A lot of these bands seem to have like found a place in the scene like they deserve to.
I have a question in this, Natasha, and I think I am also guilty. Mere bhi yehi khayal tha ke Coke Studio hai aur kuch nahi hai. And I remember I had a conversation with Zirak, and you know, he rightly so told of this thing of diaspora and like where we're just cut off. Right, like I've spent most of my life in Dubai or in Canada, and so I was completely cut off. I was only seeing what was coming out. Or phir jab aap on the ground hote hain, like to be able to find and to see this talent, and like you're saying, the outlet YouTube ban tha, and you can only look at these artists playing in like certain gigs here or there. Or Pakistan mein to, like I mean, I'd like to hear from you as well, but like there's a lot more, even like smaller ghar ke andar wala culture, less so ki aapke ek cafe mein koi gig ho rahi hai ya aapki koi like chota club hai ya yahan pe wo वो सीन तो मुझे तो नहीं लगता था कि है. Although again, I don't know as much. I would love to learn from you. Okay, where was this scene burgeoning? Because, you know, creating a platform is super important, and that's what you did with Lahore Music Festival. Because having a community, having a sense of community, because you're rightly so. Again, like bigger corporates will not give you a chance to up and to go in to that kind of realm, right? Because unko to shun karna hai aapko. Because we're the ones who are going to make money. You are nothing to me. And for a long time, that's going to be the case. But unless there come people who are like, through the system, we're going to make our own community. We're going to make our own platform. And that, I mean, you look at the world and the disruption that's happening all around the world with all of the tech companies and everything like that. That's exactly same, the exact same thing that's happening. But coming back to music, how do you even go about creating this space? And I also, one, creating this space and finding the venues and getting people to buy in. The other thing I wanted to ask, and I'm very curious about, is like, how important was that YouTube ban? Because kafi had tak ye bhi hota na ki agar aapke paas jagah nahi hai distribution ki, and that's a massive thing, distribution, right? Like today, any person who has the ability to kind of, you know, get people together can get an audience. You can put something up online and get a couple of people to watch it, and then hopefully like that grows, and there's compounding effects of putting stuff online. Like ek cheez pasand aa jayegi, they'll go in and they'll see like all of your music, so there are compounding effects there. How important was on the culture scene the banning of YouTube, and what kind of came out of that? And then the importance of also bringing people together, like what were some of the responses in that 2015, 2014 era when you first started, that people were like, oh, we didn't know that this could happen? Or like what were some of the responses and the effects of YouTube or something like YouTube that has distribution?
So, I mean, the YouTube ban came in 2010, which I was like 18 at that point, right? We had just started uploading content and covers and just songs that we had played, and like there was a democratization of distribution, as you mentioned. But the major thing was that there was no other infrastructure, right? So your only infrastructure was a TV show, a single TV show, not a TV channel, not a record label, a single TV show. And that really can't cater to like every brand or every like genre or every blend of music that, you know, might just be sprouting up. So it had like the most adverse effect on content, as we now call it. Like, you know, back then we wouldn't even have called it content. We would have said just videos lagani, right? So like now, like, you know, people who currently stand with a huge fan base on YouTube just started like really early. And they have that leverage over most people in Pakistan who just kind of like dropped the idea right there, right then. And similarly, even TikTok being banned constantly. So the act of censorship of like a very kind of accessible platform is bound to have adverse effects. Also because that means that only the rich and privileged will have their voices heard, which is still a problem, right? Which is still the case with 100%. Most of the, you know, like the upcoming musicians. Not that they should feel bad about it. It's not like they're earning any money through music. But like it does alienate a certain demographic completely, which is now kind of like now things are picking up, especially with something like TikTok, which is again banned now. But like
it's opened again.
Oh my God, amazing. Amazing. So like, you know, like, but the fact is like, it's really up in the air. You can't, you know, kind of make a 6-month plan on something like this. And that was the case back then as well. So it's very similar analogy in that sense. In terms of building a community space, I think the most important thing was to be like a middleman between an audience and your artists, right? Because the artists, the general kind of issue that a lot of them were facing and are still facing, because you're self-financing your art. Do you need to do your own PR? Do I need to learn marketing? Do I need to learn how to use Instagram? What is TikTok? You know, these are questions everyone's still asking themselves today, because all you want to do is be able to go into a studio, make a song, have somebody at most come and tell you how to make it more like accessible, and then just put that out or hand that over to somebody else. The only people who have that kind of infrastructure resources currently stand to be like corporate investors who, you know, have a different goal for at the end of the day for their music. So with these like private and independent musicians, a lot of them make phenomenal music, but just didn't have that kind of like space to be able to engage with the fan base, you know. And also it's important to be able to see your favorite bands live, right? Everyone has a favorite memory of seeing like a moment or a song or whatever. Like just being able to see that energy is also something very important. I grew up luckily in a time where like lots of Basant gigs would happen, lots of these different shows that my family would take me to. So like just like I knew what the stage was when I was young. That's why I knew I wanted to be on it at some point. Right. So like it, and that's not something that I would have been able to maybe come up with if I was just watching that on YouTube in my room on my phone. Right. The grandness of the situation doesn't come out. So I think like LMM started very small, but then it grew into that because it was active listeners who wanted to come find new music and be the cool hipsters who were like, oh, we heard this band first. Because we also enjoy saying things like, oh, we found this person first. And that's all we're getting out of it because we don't sell tickets. Because so that people like you who are just like, oh, what's happening at Alhambra? Look, their lights on. You walk in and you're like, oh my God. So you can absorb that. Because if we charge even a minimal ticket, it would like also make it again an elitist space, which it doesn't need to be. Music shouldn't is very accessible across kind of like it should be able to transcend all kind of social stratas in that sense. And it's grown into something like that where people take ownership over it, you know, and kind of it's become a place where people want to perform, which is lovely because that means that artists are being able to get that respect that they deserve and they're able to do their creative thing without anybody getting in the way. So community was just important for other artists to see other artists struggling so that they could learn with each other, collaborate, help each other out in that sense. So all we did was just put somebody like everybody in like one big space and said, do you. So I think that was all that was needed.
I love that. Just, you know, do you. It's awesome. And giving that creative freedom, sometimes, like for instance, even the Together We stuff that we were doing, like sometimes you just need that push. Sometimes you need to be able to give that push and you're surprised by what comes out and where it takes you. So it's incredible to see what you guys were doing. What's the fondest memory that you have from your music meets?
From there have been some like nice moments. So Red Blood Cat is this indie neo soul jazz band. I can't place them, but basically they wouldn't be like playing radio bangers on like 89 at some point in the day, you know. But they have excellent music, and so they were headlining at one of the LMMs, I believe it was the second one, and the audience was always a mix of 60 plus and like, you know, under 35s, because that's how we also curated the that night. I think they were opening for Mai Thai or Atawla, I forget. So we've always had like good combos for all of our lineups. So Red Blood Cat, basically like everyone over the age of 60 on their second last song just got up and gave them a standing ovation. Wow. And that was like such a wild moment because you would expect them to be like, what is this noise? But then they appreciated that much. Like that was great. Listening to like at least 1,000 people singing along to a Farish Shafi and Dalal set was also quite phenomenal. But there have been just great moments. It's just nice. Everyone's just like in a good mood. Everyone's open. There's less crankiness. There's less jadedness. And it's I think of it as like a glimpse of what the whole scene can look like, the whole industry. So it's nice. It's a nice little world to create.
That's beautiful. I have a question about something you briefly mentioned while you were answering the last question, which was, your parents used to take you to these events, Basant, I think you mentioned the Basant, and that's where you wanted, or you realized that you wanted to be on stage. Tell me a little bit about where you started. Was that the inception of Natasha wanting to sing, wanting to perform? And how would you describe your own musical evolution over the years?
I started off early in that like my parents and my siblings all listened to really good music and again like very enthusiastic listeners, and everyone had their playlists and separate cassettes and they would fight over whose cassette to play in the car. So like, you know, music was given that kind of importance and everyone just enjoyed like music and live music and just absorbing that. So I think that was ingrained in me as a very normal thing to, you know, want or to aspire to. And so when I would see all of these artists on stage, like watching Abrar Ul Haq at Lahore Fort performing when you're 6-7 years old, like that's great. Like, you know, that kind of energy, the kind of energy the crowd has, a good family mahal, also making it like just a nice wholesome experience. So I definitely think that that's where it started. My mother used to make me sing songs. Like, she just used to give me a mic similar to yours, connected to, I think it was the VCD player or something at that point, and just be like, beta, sing along. So that happened. And then I genuinely was very interested in music. I think I got my first guitar when I was 14. I tried really cool to be like a rock star. And I had a huge metal phase. But like, I couldn't growl, and I was very disappointed in myself that I could only sing. I had to take a few years to get over that. And then in college, I played a lot. I met a lot of fantastic musicians that I didn't during school. And I played with the Tuka Tuk Boys for a bit in school, actually, at the end of A-level. So that was like an interesting ride. Just met lots of different people, and kind of at some point in the middle of college, just before LMM, decided that music is what I want to be doing, because we'd be performing every couple of weeks. It'd be covers, we'd be struggling to write our own songs, like helping each other out, just kind of developing that environment. So I think at some point right after college is when I wanted to take it seriously, and like LMM had just happened. So it made it seem like a realistic option, because to like go to your parents and be like, I'm going to be a singer, like that's not going to go down well with anybody. But they laughed it off, and it's fine. They still laugh it off, and it's cute. I think it just started there. Lots of kind of curiosity, learning. I interned at True Brew Records at some point in my undergrad, right after they did Storm in a Teacup. So like, I was trying to get into the world of production, figure out who musicians are. With my own songwriting, I think I struggled a lot in my early 20s, because there was a lot of kind of like, it was a small scene, lots of judgment, no real room for lots of new genres coming out of that point. I was also handicapped because I couldn't produce. I can't, you know, like just shred on the guitar. It's just not like how I work. And so it had me boxed in for a while. And then at some point in my, like, I think in 2015, same year, I released my first single, which is still hanging around somewhere on SoundCloud. And eventually, like, I got to play at Cyan Valley, which was organized by Alien Panda Jewelry, who is this amazing electronic artist in Karachi. So we went to Nepal. I got to perform my music in Nepal for the first time to anybody, which was great, because I went there thinking, oh, okay, if this is terrible, I never have to see these people again. So perfect testing ground. But then after that, I kind of, you know, I was working in music, like management, production management, creative direction, kind of figuring out who should be with what, curation, and again, ethnomusicology, just kind of researching even before my degree in writing and publishing. So I was embedded in the scene, but the my music coming out like took a bit of time. So it's been interesting. I have an EP out now. I have a couple of singles, commercial and not commercial, out as well. So trying all the things until something makes sense.
I love it. Like, I love the honesty and the way your journey kind of comes in, right? Like, you found that you wanted to get into music. You didn't know where, but it was music. And like, finding your path, it's beautiful. And not just that, you're giving back before you're even, you know, like getting to do your own stuff. I love that. Now, question, Isime, you mentioned about not being able to produce, has big corporate been a deterrent for production houses, for indie musicians to come in to the scene and to be able to produce music as well? Or has there been support Pakistan ke andar, jahan pe aap recording studio bhi dhoond sakte ho, aapke paas koi, like, there are enough people that are able to help you, like, maine kuch gaana hai, here's something that I've written and I want to publish it, I want to produce it. Has that support been there? Or has it grown over the years?
So I would say big corporate has very little to do with this aspect. Like this, they wouldn't be getting in the way because, plenty of production houses exist, especially in Karachi. But they're focusing on entertainment in general. So not all of them are focusing on music, which means that they'll be, say, producing music for TVCs, right? So like corporate in that environment, commercial work is definitely given more preference, but there are again producers and music composers who are existing within that realm. They're just not practicing music outside of it because they're probably not necessarily musicians, but you always have somebody behind the mixer in any of these like agencies and advertising houses and production houses. So like that, that definitely exists. On the musician aspect, it's money, right? It's money at the end of the day, because to money and then also obviously privilege to be able to like not have to work, 12 hours a day at a job to be able to pay for your gear, and a space and rent and soundproofing and all of this. Like it's that's hard. But the interesting thing that happened between 2008 to 2015 is a lot of these, the artists that I mentioned earlier, they were all bedroom producing, which is again laughed at, but everyone's literally doing that now. Welcome to Corona. But like everyone's kind of, but they still made huge sounding music, right? And someone who's kind of really taking that to the next level is someone like Abdullah Siddiqui, right? He is not working in fancy studios to do what he's doing. That massive sound comes from one laptop and one microphone, and that's all he really needs to rule the world. Wow. But then there's limitations also, like, for example, because I can handle songwriting, I can handle composition, and all of that stuff. But then I'm also handling like marketing, PR, this and that for like myself, other musicians, other things. For me to also be like, all right, now I need to be a professional producer as well. Like, no, bus. So there are people then that I can rely on now as collaborators. So that's been nice, but then that's also been something in a network I've had to build actively, right? Either by putting my own music out or by like really putting myself out and being like, can we collaborate? Can we do this? Can we do that? And not everyone gets those opportunities, right? Not everyone's like Insta DMs are going to get a job. So it's definitely, it's much easier now, but I don't think that production was at any point kind of marred by big corporate, like what else? That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, there's two things that I'm really curious about. I don't know which one to go for first. One is, actually, you mentioned a little bit of it, the home production thing. Tell me a little bit of Dursa Portrait. How did that come about? What was that? It came out in Corona. I remember watching it for the first time in Corona. I listened to it again before jumping on the call with you, and I am still in like awe of all of like the production quality, the idea, the concept. Tell us about it, please.
So Dursa Portrait is actually like the title of a series that a photographer Arish Zubair does. And Arish and I had worked together previously, like 6 months before that.
Also amazing.
And so we'd been doing, yes, amazing. And so he had asked whether we wanted to record a video from my rooftop, and I was like, it can be done. And then I made him wait until I figured out which song to do, because also Corona was also happening. I had been doing this Imran Khan cover since I was like 16. Like initially it started off as like an angsty, ironic cover, which it still is in a way, but I do it with complete like no irony involved.
It's honesty.
At all.
It's just pure
honesty.
Yeah.
I didn't get what it meant when I was 15. I get what it means now. I understand the true depth of the song. So it was just a very nice casual setup. I had to use 7 extension wires to get my piano to be plugged in, but it all worked out.
I love it. Like, I mean, I'll put the link in, but it's just such, to me, that was the epitome of resilience that someone can have who is passionate. Right? Like, it's just beautiful that you're putting stuff out that's absolutely stunning, realizing the context of what's going on around the world. And like this, it's beautiful. So I loved it. Like, it was just so nice. Coming into the research part of you, what interests you? What are you writing about? What gets you excited when you start, you open up Google? What is the first thing that you type?
Oh, That's an interesting question. I don't know. It really depends on like what happens, because I'm usually going down like a spiral of music. And then you get an idea and kind of just want to dig deeper. And a lot, you can learn a lot by just looking at a cassette cover or a record cover about a song, right? Just where these songs were made, when they were made, who made them, what is a music director, that specific terminology, what did that mean in South Asian culture? For me, it's very important in a mindful way, build a future infrastructure and ecosystem for Pakistani music. It's very important for me to have the context of the things that went right and went wrong in the past, right? So that's why, like, this kind of desire to really learn what was happening in, you know, the 40s, 50s, 60s, PTV, EMI, and Radio Pakistan as institutions that were your curators back then, and how they catered to artists. The fact that Reshma was found singing in a shrine, and someone from Radio Pakistan went to go scout people like that.
Oh, I didn't know
that kind of active, you know, the having that kind of vision and that need, right? Because you needed to fill in a few hours a day of music. So you had to have people, you had lines outside of Radio Pakistan for people who would come and audition, most getting rejected. But then that's where you would find those diamonds in the rough that we're still listening to for the most part. So why was that something that could exist then? Why can't it exist now? It doesn't also just have to do with like social political milieu. It also has to do with technology, all of these things. And again, how technology has evolved to cater to present day Pakistani music, how, you know, like why, what, like we, a lot of artists were like, oh, we're making psychedelic Urdu pop. And then eventually when they would be listening to the same things from the 60s, it's like, how did this link never come up? Because that exists. Experimental music, as we would call it now, may have been experimental then, but may seem more experimental in retrospect now, even more so. You know, that's just not publicly accessible. So the main thing is just about creating access points so that someone like you or me could just kind of like go online and kind of search for Pakistani music history and get something that's definitive and not just a Wikipedia page of the same 10 people. So that's the kind of urgency to kind of research Pakistani music as well. And also, it's important to be getting like oral narratives from various people who, you know, are like, unfortunately, due to age, and economic conditions just kind of like dropping off. So like you kind of just need to be able to access them as soon as possible and make sure that you have that context and get that data.
And that's Peshkash now, right?
That's Peshkash. So Peshkash is basically an extension of my master's degree, which is looking at the Pakistani ecosystem and how that kind of the various historical strands within that. So it's been interesting just being able to through that body engage with so many people from the diaspora, you know, like in India, you know, Goras collecting, you know, brown records in from Pakistan, and that whole community of people who have old documents that can help, you know, you can fill in the blanks for each other. So Peshkash is just genuinely just there to make all of this information accessible to everybody.
Awesome. I love it. I like that's actually how I first found out about you. Because I didn't know, like, I wasn't involved in Pakistani music at all. So I had no idea. Like, in my Peshkash, I was like, holy shit, this is awesome. And I think it was because you did something with Arshia at that point as well, right? Now I have two more questions. One, three experiences that have changed you the most.
Wow. I think just, wow, three experiences is a hard question. In this context, being able to see, live through a timeline where Pakistan had like a live gig culture, I think that had a lasting impact on me that I've, you know, been carrying forward. And that's the hope for me for the future. So I think that's definitely one experience. Another experience is studying ethnomusicology and being able to have the resources and time to really understand Pakistani music and not just South Asian music or world music. So I think that was beneficial to be able to look into culture in the way that intrigued me the most. And the third experience that changed me, I would say meeting certain musicians over the course of my life who did not make fun of me. So thank you to those musicians for not making fun of me.
Yeah, amazing. Natasha, आखिरी question आपके लिए. जब आप किसी और से मिलती हैं जो पाकिस्तान में नहीं हो, ये पाकिस्तानी diaspora हो, जो आने के लिए तैयार ना हो, या जिनकी narratives बहुत negative हो पाकिस्तान के बारे में, how do you unpack Pakistan for them?
How do I unpack Pakistan for them? A lot of the times I don't, because it's for them to like kind of make that decision, get, but the information that I would give them to maybe give them, not even like, I hate the concept of soft image, but I just give them a playlist. I just give them a playlist of like what I'm listening to at this point from Pakistan. And that would primarily be it. That and just like live videos of what's happening in Pakistan at music shows, like LMM basically.
Thank you so much for listening. Please follow us on Instagram and YouTube for more stories. You can get in touch with us via email contactdastangoy@gmail.com. Until next time, thank you, shukriya, meherbani, khudafiz.